You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Talking about mental illness goes hand in hand with talking about the stigma, that fear of being judged, of having one's symptoms blamed on bad behavior rather than a disease. That stigma keeps people from seeking the medical help they need for their mental illness. My next guest hopes new innovations in brain imaging, genetics, and other technologies can help us objectively recognize that mental illness is just that, an illness. Dr. David Rosenberg is a professor of psychiatry and neuroscience at Wayne State University, and he joins us now for another installment of our Minding Michigan series. Dr. Rosenberg, you've written that as a psychiatrist, one of the toughest aspects of your job is telling parents and their children that they are not to blame for their mental health problems. Why is that?
Well, we've come such a long way, but the stigma remains huge. Think about it. For any other type of medical illness, there's a natural empathy and sympathy. And I think in a lot of cases with mental illness, that's the case. But there's still this feeling that it's under the power of a child or their family, that if the parents were good, if they were better.
So what did I do wrong, doctor?
What did I do wrong? Mm. How did I go wrong? It's my fault. And I look at it, for example, with diabetes. Would somebody be blaming their pancreas for not secreting insulin? Would you be yelling at a child or a parent that you're not good parents because your kid's pancreas isn't working properly? It just doesn't make any sense.
And they don't – so they have a hard time accepting when you tell them it is not your fault?
You can't see it. There are no current objective markers of psychiatric illness. If you go to any clinic in the country, in Arkansas, in Michigan, in New York, and you get a sugar reading, it's going to be basically the same wherever you are. But that's not the case in psychiatry. And so as a child and adolescent psychiatrist – by far, one of the hardest parts of my job is convincing good parents and good children that they're not to blame for the illness. And it's really a societal problem because children with mental health problems are the diagnostic and therapeutic orphans of American healthcare.
How so?
Well, in a system that we have, it's dominated by politics and money. Who's going to pay the bills? And it's probably why we have Medicare rather than Pedicare, and literally millions of American children who can't get good mental health care. Despite more information about it, despite people talking about it, it remains elusive for the vast majority of children and their families in this country.
And then when you think of the stress that having, let's say, an anxious child or an obsessive compulsive child, and you say parents feeling guilty, getting angry because they're only human, so then you're setting up years and years without proper treatment of all kinds of negative dynamics within that family.
That's exactly right. And we know that the best predictor of a good response to treatment is an accurate diagnosis. But that's far more difficult than it sounds. I've written 3 textbooks on using medicines in children and adolescents with emotional and behavioral problems. And I never do that lightly. I always look for non-medication interventions. When the diagnosis is made correctly, when the medicines are used correctly, though, they can be literally life-saving for children and their families. But what makes this more complicated is the fact that we still don't have any objective markers of psychiatric illness.
And you are working on that, and you wrote a piece in theconversation.com talking about the ways and techniques that you're trying to really get in there and get that objective identification. Particularly, you're doing some real interesting things using the latest brain imaging technology to figure out what's going on with obsessive compulsive disorder. Tell us what you're doing.
Well, a lot of us builds on history because there are many bona fide medical and neurologic conditions today that have had all of the stigma years ago. So if it were 1917 rather than 2017, epilepsy had all of the stigma and was actually considered a psychiatric condition. And here's the kicker. Back in the Middle Ages, people with epilepsy were considered to be possessed by the devil. So up until the 1930s, when people were considered to be lunatics and to have a psychiatric problem locked up in lunatic asylums, that was actually considered advanced thinking. because now they no longer thought you were possessed by the devil. They were crazy. Who else would urinate and defecate on themselves? Who else would shake all about but a crazy person? And it was a psychiatrist by the name of Hans Berger who in 1924 discovered something called the electroencephalogram, or EEG, and found that the cause was electrical abnormalities in the brain.
And you could see it right there on the reading.
You could see it, and even more, based on the pattern and where the abnormality was. Was it in the front of your brain, the side of the brain, the back of the brain? That would determine and dictate an entirely different treatment. That's what we're trying to do because we believe that knowledge heals, and it's going to defeat ignorance and stigma every time. Without it, it makes it more complicated, and our goal is not to replace good physicians, not to replace good psychologists and therapists. You always need a good doctor, but to give them added tools to be able to see the illness and to identify specific subtypes of the illness.
And what you've done with these brain imaging studies with OCD patients, you've actually been able to identify a part of the brain that is not firing right.
We find areas of the brain that aren't firing right, and we also find that not all obsessive compulsive disorder is the same.
So, just like not all cancers are the same.
Not all cancers, not all high blood pressure is the same. Not all diabetes is the same. There are insulin-dependent diabetes, type 1 diabetes, non-insulin-dependent diabetes, type 2 diabetes. And guess what? If you treat them the same, it's disastrous. Insulin can be life-saving for an insulin-dependent diabetic. It could be very dangerous and not helpful in someone who has type 2 diabetes.
So for instance, your brain imaging studies, what kind of technology and tests are you using to get these results?
It's really like something out of science fiction. It's unimaginable. And the technology we have 15, 20 years ago, we could never have seen the things that we're seeing.
The detailing, yeah.
We can measure precise physiology, how the brain functions, how the brain networks talk to each other and communicate with each other, the brain's chemistry, details about the structure, the size, the form. And I think something else that's so critical is that when I say we're looking to identify new subtypes of the illness, I believe in the next 10 years there'll be 10 or more different subtypes of depression, 10 or more subtypes of obsessive compulsive disorder. And our research, our MRIs, is very clear that in a child with obsessive compulsive disorder who has fears about contamination, washes their hands over and over again, as compared to a child who checks the door, locks over and over again, their brains look completely different.
Different things are going on. I was struck that, for example, you found in some patients there's something called the anterior cingulate cortex. It doesn't give the all-clear signal. That makes total sense. So the brain isn't satisfied that things are good.
That's exactly right.
And you can see that. What does it do to patients and families when you can go, look right here, let me show you this? What's it do for them?
It's a game changer. Pure and simple, it just validates them in many ways, even though we always reassure and tell them that this is research. This is not clinically indicated yet. We hope someday that it will have a clinical use, but right now they are being the heroes, the pioneers, to help hopefully other children and their families in the future. That being said, when they're able to actually see a brain scan and see a clear abnormality, something that isn't working properly in the brain, rather than being fearful, they finally feel validated. And I remember one parent and child both exclaiming that, you know, everyone's always told us this is all in your head, and it is all in my head, but I can see it. And most exciting of all is with some of our more recent research is that we find that with appropriate treatment, those brain abnormalities can normalize with effective treatment.
So you can help pinpoint treatment.
Pinpoint the treatment and pick the particular treatment that's most likely to be effective. So, for example, we find different chemical and functional changes in children who respond to cognitive behavioral therapy than those who respond to medication treatment. And some who need the combination treatment may have different patterns in addition.
You're at an early stage with this. So where do you hope this work will be able to lead you and other psychiatrists?
Very very early stage. And, you know, I think at Wayne State, we are collaborating with the University of Michigan, the University of Calgary on a major grant funded by the National Institute of Mental Health studying obsessive compulsive behaviors, not just in children with obsessive compulsive disorder, but depression, anxiety, tic, Tourette, autism spectrum conditions. And we are now using these brain imaging tools in combination with sophisticated genetic analyses in the same children and their families. And we think that we can begin to pinpoint the genes that are involved and how that impacts brain function. So it's really a brave new world where, as we hope, knowledge is going to heal and defeat the pervasive stigma that still exists.
And then I think I hear you say the other side of that fight is access to this kind of technology for all patients, that you talk about kids being orphans. And I'm sure you don't want to see a world where some have access and others are left to muddle along.
This is a huge societal problem, because one of the striking things that I find when I talk with legislators, administrators, doctors, others, policymakers, is everyone agrees that more mental health services are needed, more child and adolescent psychiatrists, more psychologists. Then when you get around to who's going to pay for it, that's when people typically run for the hills. And what's sad is that oftentimes people can be easily convinced and showed the enormous cost to society if you don't correct or deal with these problems.
Look at our prisons.
Look at the prisons. Look at the shootings that occur. Look at everywhere. And in prison, as you mentioned, at least a third, probably more, may have schizophrenia and other very devastating illnesses. So we know the cost in terms of to society. We know that the economic burden is huge. Sometimes, though, in a system where you have to balance a budget in a single year, people don't seem to care as much about that.
A voice from the trenches, definitely. Dr. David Rosenberg, who is chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Neuroscience at Wayne State University and the Detroit Medical Center. Thanks for sharing your work with us, Doctor.
My pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Joey Herron, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.